Do you know the chant by heart? We don't have a... In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood,
from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels.
Whatever
the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all our steps on the path to omniscience, may these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this.
So, let's see. So the plan had been to do a course on logic during this slot, and then to do a course that would lead up to a course on Madhyamaka using Mipham Rinpoche's commentary on the ninth chapter. On the ninth chapter of the Bodhicharyavatara, very famous commentary, very controversial commentary that spurred a lot of criticism from certain Gelugpa Kenpos or Geshes, and back and forth letters and texts and some very heated words were exchanged.
At the time.
And so this translation came out about a year or two ago by Padmakara Translation Committee, so quite a good, you know, reliable translation. And they also included some of the back and forth in it, which would be cool. But it's difficult text, and pramana is not easy either. Pramana is difficult as well. So I thought we could do a couple of classes as like introductory. They wanted us to do a couple of test sessions for us to see how this worked out, and before we like commit to a longer thing. And so I thought let's do a couple of classes on overview of pramana, and then if everything's working, we'll jump into going through this book, The Sword of Wisdom, which is a poem by Mipham the Great. It's about maybe 8 or 10 pages, the actual poem, and then there's a commentary by a Tibetan scholar who died maybe 5 years ago, Kenpo Paulden Sherab Rinpoche, really wonderful Tibetan Nyingma teacher, sweetest and nicest you've ever met, and humblest and very learned, and generally considered to be among or the top Mipham scholar in the Nyingma world. And so he wrote a commentary on this. And he wrote it initially when he was teaching at the Central Institute of Central Institute for Tibetan Studies in Varanasi, India. After the Tibetans all came out from Tibet in the early 60s, the Dalai Lama and the various scholastic entities coordinated with the Dalai Lama and the other lamas of the lineages and put together this Institute of Tibetan Studies, sort of a Rime Institute of higher Tibetan studies for tulku, you know, advanced Kenpo, Geshe type training. And they all chose him to be one of the main teachers. And he would teach pramana, and he used this text, and he taught it a number of times. And over the years, some students of his compiled his notes into sort of a rough, sort of bullet point type thing. And then he took that and he turned it into a text as a commentary. And then a student of Trungpa Rinpoche's, Anne Helm, a number of years ago, started to translate it with him, and and found it very difficult and put it aside. And I reconnected with her over the at some point, and we were talking about what she was doing, and she said that she had started that, and I was like, oh, please do that. Because actually we had done this as a course years ago, using a translation by Ives Waldo, which was like indecipherable. I don't know if people remember that. You guys were probably here. Right? Yeah, the light of the sun and the moon.
Oh yeah, I have it.
Yeah.
It was a big one. That was good.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I got it still.
Oh. And so she was inspired to restart the project and spent many meetings with him going over it, and finally finished it, succeeded. And so it seems from my memory of it, it presents a very good overview of all of the Pramana tradition. And so from that point of view, it should be a good entree into that whole tradition, as opposed to jumping into the main texts of that tradition, which are rather incomprehensible for if you don't have a deep background in that tradition. And they're not entirely translated. The main, so to sort of start with an overview before we jump into the reading for tonight. Actually in the reading he'll go through the main texts, but basically the context for Pramana is follows the following logic, as far as I can tell, and it's about logic, and so it has this logic to it, is how do we become enlightened? We've done this quiz before, right? Not too long ago. Remember? How do you get enlightened? How does enlightenment happen?
Removal of obscurations.
Say the first part again.
Removal of the obscurations.
Removal of obscurations, or elimination of obscurations. And the obscurations are not specifically, but generally, the obscurations are
disturbing emotions and
mistaken beliefs.
Mistaken beliefs about reality, right? Mistaken beliefs about reality. So ignorance, wrong view, basically, right? And the premise there is that if you understand the true nature of reality by dispelling wrong view, those obstructions, then you achieve enlightenment, right? That enlightenment comes about through a direct understanding of the true nature of reality. True nature of reality is roughly, so that's the premise, right? That in Buddhism is we overcome ignorance through wisdom and achieve enlightenment. We achieve nirvana by overcoming ignorance through wisdom. And so, the way the Shedra, the curriculum, the path of study and practice in Buddhism is organized around that sort of logic of, okay, so if you understand the nature of reality, then you achieve enlightenment. So we'll start with, if you have a certain or direct experience, understanding, or correct understanding of the nature of reality, then you achieve enlightenment. Three things, right? So take the middle one, correct understanding of the nature of reality. So the nature of reality, we begin by understanding what appears to our senses, what appears to our mind. We start there with our direct experience of what kind of reality? Conventional or relative reality, right? Relative reality, appearance, the world of appearance. Things, dharmas, so that's Abhidharma. So we start by analyzing, using the whole Abhidharma system of what is our experience of, direct experience of the world. We have our senses, we have the skandhas, we have ayatanas and dhatus, we have mental factors, and that whole scheme of Abhidharma, of dividing up and analyzing, defining, and explaining what do we experience and how in a very simple, straightforward way. And through that process, then we begin to understand what is ultimate reality. Ultimate reality generally being held to be in Buddhism as what? What are some of the distinguishing ways of explaining ultimate reality?
Absence of self.
Absence of self. Selflessness, right? Or?
Interdependence.
Interdependence.
I would say indistinguishability would be something to distinguish.
Indistinguishability, which is somewhat synonymous with?
Lack of
correct
characteristics.
Non-dual.
Non-dual. It's really simple what I'm looking for.
Emptiness.
So that we study through Madhyamaka. What is the true nature of reality? What is conventional truth? What is ultimate truth? How do we distinguish them? How do we come to an understanding of ultimate truth? What is ultimate truth? And then the first part of the hypothesis or whatever, proposition of how do we gain enlightenment by achieving a direct understanding of the nature of reality is that there's a nuance there, that there's indirect understandings of phenomena or world, and there's direct or it's true or certain understanding. So it's not just like an intellectual understanding of the nature of reality that yields enlightenment. We all know that because we all have that already, and it hasn't worked for me. I don't know about you guys. Bless you. You know, so we're not talking about an intellectual understanding of reality, but we're talking about some very more deep or different type of understanding or experience of reality. And that's the notion of pramana. Pramana is this notion of that there's two ways of knowing things. There's sort of a surface level intellectual way of knowing things through conceptuality. And then there's the way of knowing things that yields incontrovertible understanding of it. And so an incontrovertible understanding of the nature of reality as being egolessness or emptiness yields enlightenment, results or is enlightenment. So we study that whole range. We study the experience, our experience of our world, the relative world, Abhidharma. We study Madhyamaka. And when we study Madhyamaka, which I think many of us have been exposed to over the years. We read Madhyamaka, books on Madhyamaka, we go to teachings on emptiness and Madhyamaka. And why does it not work? Why does it not happen? Right? Why do we not get it? You know, you read Nagarjuna's writings, everything is empty, Nirvana and Samsara are the same. We can say these things over and over. And it just doesn't change your stuckness in Samsara. And the hypothesis is that is because you haven't actually understood it in a pramana sense, in a completely direct, incontrovertible level of understanding. Did you raise your hand? Were you saying something? I can't really see you guys that well, so. And feel free to chime in, by the way.
Does pramana mean, so pramana not being an English word, me translating that in my mind to some concept in English would be like, from what I'm picking up, is contextually close to the word like experience. It's like you can have the knowledge and you can have the experience, and they're two different sort of things. So is pramana closer towards someone who then experiences said practice versus understands it from a knowledge basis?
It includes the range, actually, of those. Of the idea that there are different ways of experiencing things, of knowing things, and distinguishing which ones are more powerful, so to speak, or transformative, and how to achieve those, how to come about having that type of understanding or experience of a knowledge object, of an object of knowledge. And so pramana is this field of study of looking at that whole range of how do we know things? How do we know the Dharma? And how can we know the Dharma in a way that'll be transformative? And so in addition to like focusing on the object, Dharma, the teachings of emptiness and this and that, we also look at, well, how are we understanding that? What kind of mind do we bring to it? Do we bring our normal conceptual confused mind to that? How do we make the leap from a conceptual understanding of emptiness, intellectual, to a direct cognition of emptiness? And what does that mean? So I thought for these first two test classes, instead of diving into the book, we could go over some general introductions of those, of this topic. And so I circulated a couple of things. The first one, I think, was a little bit more difficult, so I circulated a second one that I think is less difficult. And I brought four hard copies. So I think I got three requests for hard copies. You were one. Who else needs one? John was one. Can you pass that to John? Do you need one, anybody? Noir?
If somebody else wants it.
I think you spoke up for that. Yeah. Hopefully I have this electronic. Perfect. So this is from a program that was taught by Kenpo Sochum Gyamso at Karma Cholin in 2005. And at a certain point, he'd been teaching there for like 12 years every summer. And at a certain point, he asked some of his senior students to teach most of the program that year. It was like every year was like a 2-week program or so at Karma Cholin. I was fortunate to attend a lot of them. And by the way, here's hard copies of the ones for next week. Anya.
Thank you.
Noir and John. No, for next week, different text. Oh, same thing is circulated here. So. So he, Kenpo Sochum Gyamso taught an amazing array of subjects, and he was, as a Kenpo, he's like a really scholarly guy, but he's also this amazing yogi guy. It's very unlike what you think of like as a scholar, because he's a complete yogi and unfettered by anything. And like I helped host him a number of times coordinate these programs. And I remember one time him coming and helping him arrive, and he had a little suitcase, and that was it. And I helped him bring it to the room, and he wanted, I think, something from the suitcase, and he had me open it up, and it was literally like two more robes and a shirt, and I can't remember exactly, but there was like the guy, you know, he was traveling for like months, and there was like nothing. He had like literally like almost nothing with it.
Who is he? Sorry.
Kenpo Sochum Gyamso.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And a book, and then he had a book. And he would constantly make you sing songs, which I'll spare you. But
they're really corny, too.
They're so corny. Oh my God. And he had this one student in particular that he'd been working with for years on translating these songs and translating them in a way that could be put to music, to tunes. And this guy somehow decided to use cowboy type tunes, Jim Scott. So there were all these songs that he did that we would sing. They were like cowboy tunes. Westerns.
Great.
Anyway, another one of the students that he had teaches this gentleman, Scott Wellenbach, And Scott has recently become quite famous for in a very unusual way. Scott, unbeknownst to most of us until recently, was for somehow he became, over the years of his youth, very good at playing poker. He's also a translator. He's one of the main translators in the Nalanda Translation Committee for many, many years. They translate all the texts that, for our liturgies, and Trungpa Rinpoche wrote in Tibet, now they're working on. And a year ago, he started playing in competitions. He thought he would see, apparently he used to do this years ago, so he would go once a year and play poker, just like for fun, and see if he could win any money, and would donate whatever he won. And apparently, like years ago, he would go and win like very small amounts of money, like maybe 5,000 or 10,000, you know, at the most, maybe 10,000 or something. And about a year ago, he won like $80,000 or something and donated it all, like gave a bunch to Kenpo and some other organizations. I was like, wow. And then like a couple of months ago, or a month ago, I was in Halifax, and suddenly there was this news that he had won $670,000 playing poker in some big game in East Asia, Southeast Asia.
And he made it home alive?
He made it home alive. And that was U.S. dollars, and then in Canadian dollars. That was in Canada when we heard about it. It's like almost $1 million Canadian dollars.
Wow.
It's like, whoa. And they were interviews of him. You can search on his name and see these things. And he's planning to give all of the money to Dharma, to different Dharma groups. And he's just such a genuine, simple, no bullshit guy. He's very, very interesting. And he's very smart. And he's a wonderful teacher and translator. So anyway, he was one of the people that became very good in this topic of pramana. And he taught and still teaches for many years at Phunlen Rinpoche's Nitarta Institute, which is focused on the Kagyu version of the Shaedra curriculum, using commentaries by various karmapas on the five texts of the Shaedra curriculum. And so he still teaches at Nitarta pretty much, I think, every year. And just briefly, the five topics of the Shaedra curriculum, I mentioned a few of them, right? I mentioned pramana is one of them, the study of logic, or pramana really, people translate it as logic or valid cognition, but it sort of has this umbrella, it's used as a term that has this umbrella meaning of the study of how do we know and how do we come to appreciate certain understanding or definitive understanding or transformative understanding. And then there's Abhidharma, the study of reality, so to speak, conventional realities in particular. And those two pretty much serve as the supports, sort of like I imagine the schema as being like a body, and the pramana and Abhidharma are like the legs that provide the tools and the background that we need to really progress on the path in terms of understanding what are we doing when we meditate and how do we come to understand reality, both intellectually and then non-conceptually. And so they feed into the combined sort of practice or topics of meditation, which I'd say is like the body, and then Madhyamaka, the nature of reality, or the middle way. Madhyamaka is really middle way, understanding of reality, and then the path. So how do we actually progress in understanding Abhidharma and Pramana in such a way that it supports our meditation and our understanding of the nature of reality. So those are the five topics. traditionally, the instead of meditation, the Shaedra curriculum has the Vinaya, the study of the rules of the monastic system. And since that doesn't apply much for us, I decided to shift it out for meditation. And strangely enough, they don't have meditation in the Shaedra, because meditation is separate from the Shaedra. Shaedra's for study. And it was a given that the whole monastery was about practice. And so only those that were interested in study would then also go to the Shaedra, the monastic college. Okay, so he begins this text, so I'm on page 49.
Just one question about
sure,
that.
Yeah.
Is there so like an idea that this education on these five topics is necessary in order to tread the path? Or is this kind of like optional?
Oh, yeah. It's very much optional. So you don't need to bang your head against the wall with all this weird stuff. You know, blur
you
your
said
eyes.
Said the first article, the second one, because I can't find it. I can't find this thing. I have the
Scott Wellenbeck one.
Yeah, I'm just looking for any clues as to when that. When you sent that.
February 17th.
Yeah. Can you forward me that one?
I'm not online.
No? Okay.
Or I can.
That's okay. Never mind. I don't think I have it.
The name of the email is Return of Rimei Shedra.
Okay, no worries.
Sorry, it's February 19th.
Okay. Derek, when you said they were in the Shedras, in the Shedras or in the monastery, they did meditation. Now, was that shamatha vipassana, or was that other kinds of meditation that these young monks and whoever.
I just sent it to Cynthia. Okay. No, they would mostly do pujas and then sadhanas, sadhana practices.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
Which is a whole nother topic. But. The idea is that you would go to the Shaedra program. One reason was to be able to teach the Dharma to others and help others understand the Dharma, and which is sort of like a little bit circular in that if others need to learn the Dharma, then why aren't they also going to the Shaedra? Why would, you know, are you learning things at the Shaedra that you're not teaching to them? Or if you're teaching everything, anyway. But the idea is that the more you understand, the more it helps your practice, your meditation experience. Up to a point. There's certainly a point where you can just learn facts and figures and it doesn't help your meditation, or you can, just like anything else in the world, you can become obsessed with it and distracted from your meditation practice. But the idea is that, which pramana really presents more than any other topic, is that there's this sense that there's two ways to gain enlightenment for that process of breaking through and breaking through wrong view and having a direct, correct view of reality. And one way is for you to spontaneously just break through and drop all of your conceptual projections about reality. All of your belief in the self just fall away. And that can happen, maybe you get really, bless you or something, maybe you get really, really sick, or maybe you're in a car accident, Or maybe your guru slaps you with his sandal or her sandal, as in the famous story of Tilopa Naropa. And the idea is that that's pretty rare, and that a more sort of reliable path is what's called inference, inferential understanding, that you gradually refine your understanding of emptiness so that to go from your current state of mind to the leap that's required into a direct non-conceptual experience of emptiness, you're closer already in some ways. To go from a confused mind that has no notion of what emptiness is and what wrong view is, all the way to correct view, is a longer jump, so to speak. So the idea is that the more you refine your understanding, you become more conscious, more aware of wrong view and how that operates in your every cognitive moment, as opposed to just like, oh, when I have a klesha attack, I know that's screwed up. I mean, that's pretty clear. But, you know, what we don't generally understand is that every mental moment is obscured. And how is it obscured? What is that obscuration that's going on? And so by studying all this, we become much more clear about what is it that we're missing every moment, and how are we missing it, the point. And so therefore, the logic is that it's easier to go from a very refined inferential, i.e. intellectual or cognitive, conceptual rather, understanding of reality to a direct one, than from just total naive materialist to enlightenment. Now some others along the way will complain about that. And prasangikas in general will say that they don't think that they think studying logic is a waste of time, and at the same time they will study logic. It's one of those things where they're saying, if you're studying logic, you're just like getting your mind more complicated. You're creating more complications. And really what they're doing is saying that as you're studying, that it's good to study and understand more, but you need to understand that the purpose of understanding is to simplify your mind, not to complexify your mind. So he begins by quoting this text, and instead of going through this quote, he'll later on explain what this text is and its significance. On the other hand, at the very bottom of the page, he says, the presentation of the classifications of mind, which is the name of this text by the seventh Karmapa, has three parts. And this is helpful. The definitions of mind, what is mind, the divisions of mind, and the concluding summary, which states the whole thing in terms of logical reasonings, logical syllogisms. So there are definitions of mind, and the way that this text is written is in this format of logical syllogisms or examples that support logical syllogisms. And we'll get into what a logical syllogism is later, but there are definitions of mind, because the definition of mind is. So the way this sentence is constructed is, it's saying, there are definitions of mind because I'm about to give you one. So therefore there are definitions, because I just gave you one, right? Is that which is clear and aware. Mind is that which is clear and aware. The definition of consciousness is that which is aware of objects. And the definition of awareness is that which experiences an object of comprehension. So these are three different terms, related terms, related entities, related dharmas in our scheme of dharmas. And so instead of just defining mind, he's providing definitions of all three of these, because they're in some sense synonymous. But they each have a different definition because they have slightly different functions. but it's very hard to parse out consciousness from a mind and awareness from consciousness or a mind.
So you said they are synonymous, or?
They are synonymous. They are.
It's like a Venn diagram.
It's like a Venn diagram where they're basically synonymous. It's like they have slightly different nuances. And as we go through, we'll come back to these and the differences between them. This is so because it is stated in such texts as the Commentary on Valid Cognition, and we'll come to what that text is shortly. Consciousness is the phenomenon, or dharma, that apprehends an object. In this context, in the presentation of the classifications of mind, there are many ways to posit definitions as well as negations and positions. These are to be known from the surging waves of the ocean of text and reasoning, a critical analysis of mind, and the surging waves on the ocean of text and reasoning, a critical analysis of reasons. So he's citing his own other subsidiary works. And so in this scheme of what's called pramana, there are these subsidiary branches that are the approach to the substance, the main body of pramana. And one is a critical analysis of mind, is what are the types of mind? What are the divisions of mind, and what are the divisions of mental states? And then the other is, what are the divisions of reasons and reasoning, and types of logical reasonings? And so those are sort of the primers for the larger topic of pramana. And we did classes on these for those of you that were here many years ago, where we studied these little root texts. And they're little like, it's like the Lowric is the classifications of mind. And we never really made it to Tarik. Rik is classifications in Tibetan, and Lo is mind. And Ta is signs or reasons. And there are two out of a triad of three, like core little root texts that support the Abhidharma and the Pramana traditions. In Abhidharma, the core text is called Collected Topics. And it just gives definitions of all of the skandhas and all of the dharmas. In like a chart of the 75 or 100 dharmas, it just goes through them one after another, says what their definition is, and then helps you understand how they differ from each other, how they're related, how they're different, why they're grouped together, why many of them are grouped in different groups, and what the significance of those groups is, and so forth. So it's like a crib notes to the whole scheme of understanding the Abhidharma. So these are like little crib notes.
What was that core text that you said again? The
Collected Topics.
So the author of all these surging waves things was?
I believe this is the Seventh Karmapa who, I'm a little confused here.
Okay.
Which part is the Karmapa's text versus the Kenpo commenting on that, Kenpo Tsultram, he may be quoting, but anyway, we know the next section is Scott. During this class, we'll be studying a text composed by Kenpo that is entitled The Lowric, The Classifications of Mind, or Mental States. We will be looking at this root Lowric text and drawing on commentaries given at Nitarta by two of Kenpo's students, Dzogchen Punlop, Rinpoche, and Acharya Sherab Gelson, which are available in transcript form. Lowric is here translated as Classifications of Mind, through which, though we will touch on some alternative translations of that title, it is part of the general study of what is known as pramana in Sanskrit. The word pramana, which is translated as tsema in Tibetan, and he gives the transliteration, has two parts. The first is the prefix pra, which means best or highest in Sanskrit, and we're familiar with that from the word prajna. And mana comes from the word ma, which means measure or how or to know. Interestingly, one of its more unusual meanings is to ascertain. So pramana is the best knowledge, the best measure, the highest ascertainment. And so we'll see that the root text as well as Scott's presentation are all basically given in this very sort of deliberate, slow, measured way, where things are presented in topics and terms and information is presented very in a very careful way, and we try to define things, what we're talking about, talk about how they're related and where they come from, because it's considered to be very helpful in understanding the deeper subjects and presentations and topics, where otherwise you get very confused about, like, well, how did mind relate to consciousness and awareness and so forth? And so it's very helpful just to from the starters, we're all on the same page, you know. What is consciousness?
That which is aware of objects.
Right. And what is awareness? And an object of comprehension, how does that relate to objects? And what we haven't gone over, which is this neat concept, is the Venn diagram of relations. And dharmas or phenomena, objects of cognition, can either, they can either be the same entity with different like names or terms, or they can be related to each other by one entity being a subset of another. So apples are a type of fruit, as are oranges. But apples and oranges are different entities when you look at them as themselves. But if you say fruit, then they're part of that whole. And apples and oranges are exclusive. Their relationship is exclusive. The set of apples excludes the set of oranges. The set of apples and oranges are included in the set of fruit, however. And then let's say, I can't think of a good example, unfortunately, but let's say that there's types of fruits which are not edible food, and maybe there are, but let's say there are some types of fruits that are not edible food.
Poisonous berries,
right? Okay, so then we say there's this another group of food items, edible items, edible food, right? So there's a big set of that. Apples fit in edible food. Oranges fit in edible food from the fruit family, but poisonous berries are not in the group of edible food. So when you compare edible fruit and edible food, they overlap, but they're not either contiguous, they're not identical, they're not exclusive, right? So they have some part of them overlaps. So you have these four or really three types of relationships. One is that one group is within another group, or one group, or the two groups are completely separate, or they overlap in some way.
Including identically.
So that's the fourth one, is that they're identical with just different names and sort of colors or something insignificant. So those four things, they're identical in terms of entity, right? And other places we've talked about that there's two ways of classifying dharmas. One's in terms of entity, and one's in terms of function. And another one is in terms of terminology, just like terminological differences. Things have just different names based on different usages. So again, those four relationships. One is that they're identical, but with different terminology. They have different terms. Or another, the second one is that one fits within another one. And the third one is that they're overlapping. And then the fourth one is that they're mutually exclusive.
Here it looks like the mind is the encompasses everything. Consciousness sits in mind and awareness sits in consciousness. And all of that, of course, sits in mind.
Within, okay, so that's one proposition, is that mind is the larger entity and consciousness and awareness both sit within it, are included within it. And then you are tasked with coming up with types of mind that are not consciousness or awareness. Excuse me, I have to go to the bathroom real quick. Let me pause. But yeah, when
some supplicant who came in, right? He's like, well, I refuse to answer this gentleman because whatever I said he was going to take as dogma, and it would have led him astray, so I couldn't say anything.
That's correct. So
aren't there occasionally sneaky teachers who might say things a little screwy?
I don't know.
To mess with us a little bit? No, I'm like that, okay.
Anyway, the next thing is like the most important part of the whole scheme is that started on page 52. Which starts with the word Buddhism and the word
52.
Yes, the next page. The first word is Buddhism, and what we're missing from the page before is the word in. In Buddhism, there are said to be three, whereas there's a possible range of six, but the relevant ones are three, and they are direct experience. These are the three types of possible types of pramana, a best valid understanding. Direct experience, what we directly perceive. The second is inference, logic, logical mind, reasoning, what we can figure out. The third is what one might call reliable authority. Now it's 9:03 and she's going to come back and escort us out. So,
Teresa, she wasn't coming back.
Oh.
So we can stay here all night.
But let's see if we can go through this briefly without a lot of confusion or questions about it. If that's not helpful,
so that
then we'll revisit it.
The previous one where it puts the reliable authorities, which were the subject of the first two of the last triad, right?
Right. And the next paragraph, he's going to, as we go through this, they're going to drop number three, reliable authority, as not being a really incontrovertible type of pramana. The first is direct perception. Sense perception is the most familiar example of this, but the Lowrick system presents other subtle and more important aspects of direct experience. For example, when Kenpo Rinpoche was leaving the room this morning, he mentioned self-awareness, which turns out to be the key and most prime example of direct experience. The capability of knowing what we know, knowing what we're experiencing. But to start on a more ordinary level, it's easier for us to see direct experience as sense perception. What we see, color and shape, what we hear, sound, what we taste, what we smell, what we touch, the feelings that impinge on our body. This is a direct experience prior to concept. So in the Buddhist system, sense perceptions are non-conceptual. The redness of red, the chirping of a bee, it is direct experience before we label it, before we say things like, I like, I don't like, or any other evaluation of the experience. Thus, direct experience is one source of pramana, a main source of pramana. The second source of pramana is inference, direct perception, as important as it is for human beings, this side of enlightenment is a little bit limited. He's saying for human beings who are not enlightened, direct perception is a little bit limited. We need more help. For instance, if smoke comes billowing through the open door of the shrine and we have a direct sensory experience of gray billowing matter, and even before we smell it, we identify through sight and say to ourselves, smoke. And then we would say, oh, there must be a fire out there or in there. This is because we know the relationship, the certain relationship, and this is key, is that we believe there's a certain relationship between these two, of between smoke and fire. When there's smoke, there's fire, as we say in English, right? That is a logical inference. It's one of the most similes. It can be wrong, right? So the certain, that idea of a certain, where was it?
Relationship.
Certain relationship is key. Is it a certain relationship or not? Where there's smoke, there's fire. Let's see. We do not see the fire directly. We do not smell it. We do not taste it. And we do not feel its heat. Yet, we can logically deduce its existence from the sight of it. We need that sort of tool to manage our lives. So inference is essential. We use inference constantly, all the time, without it really knowing. We just immediately assume most of what we do all day long of our experiences, inference, based on that. The third is reliable authority. This concerns valid cognitions that we cannot know directly this side of enlightenment, nor can we prove them logically. There are things that we need to trust. In Vajrayana communities in the West, the pramana of reliable authority usually begins with the two words, Rinpoche said. But more generally, of course, it's the scriptural authority of Lord Buddha, what he said. For instance, the law of karma. Now, the law of karma is this great example. It's the main example of something that is beyond the direct and inferential understanding of any non-Buddha, basically. The idea is that the workings of karma are so subtle and extensive and vast that it's impossible for anybody who's not highly realized to understand karma and what the results of some actions are going to be, or what current situations are the result of past actions. It is said that if one is generous, one will reap that what one sows. One will have a rich existence. But when we look at this side from the perspective of our own experience, does that seem to be true? For some people who are generous, generosity does seem to come back to them, but others might seem to get nothing back and they end up in poverty. On the other hand, some people who are downright niggardly, it's an odd word to use, may win the lottery. The Buddha says that it's not necessarily in this life that karma plays itself out. It could be in a future life. But we cannot ascertain this from our own experience, and it's very difficult to prove it logically. So this is something that one needs to at least provisionally take on trust. We can trust this type of searching since other things the Buddha said seem to be true, either to our direct experience or to what we can logically deduce. So therefore, we can rely on other of his instructions, even those that we cannot verify for ourselves. So we go through this process of saying, well, the Buddha said these other things that I can experience directly, or I can logically understand when I subject them to a rigorous logical analysis. And he also said this stuff about karma. So I'm going to sort of take that on sort of faith, because his other stuff I find to be true. We are asked to try this out and see how it affects our lives when we take it to be so. For example, how does it affect our life if we actually put generosity into practice? So he doesn't mention it here, but we'll get to it, and I think it's helpful to mention it here, that these three types of pramana each have a different object. Now, objects are classified in many different ways. And one way is in terms of their evidenceability. What would you call it? Their availability to our experience. And so objects of direct cognition are said to be evident. Objects of the other types of pramana are said to be hidden. So an object is either evident or hidden. Mm-hmm. all the objects of the five senses are evident, right? They're there. Objects of logic, of inferential cognition, is hidden. It's, you can't, hidden in the sense that you can't experience it through your five sense consciousnesses. Simple as that, the definition is that. Is something you can't cognize through your five sense consciousnesses, but you can get at through logic, is a hidden object. Impermanence is a hidden object. There's two types of hidden objects, like normal hidden objects and very hidden objects. The very hidden object is karma.
Karma.
Emptiness is a hidden object, right? So you can't get at emptiness through direct cognition through the five senses.
Are hidden? I was just going to ask then, but the sixth conscious, then inference, is then getting at potentially hidden things that aren't immediately evident?
All the objects of inferential cognition are hidden objects.
Are hidden objects believed to exist?
Are hidden objects believed to exist? They are not specifically characterized phenomena. And so it depends what you mean by exist.
And that's another course.
Are processes objects?
Are processes objects? No, those are inferences.
So karma is a process?
Yeah.
Not an object?
Yeah, so change is an inference. Impermanence is an inference. Because impermanence, change, karma happen over time. And the
time itself is an inference,
and the idea is that the phenomena that exist in one moment only exist in that moment, and they don't exist in any other moment. And so for you to say that, and so you can't experience the same phenomena in another moment, and so for you to say there's change is based on an inference that there's some relationship between those two different objects.
I thought you referred to karma as a hidden object.
It's a very hidden object, yeah.
But if it's an inference, then...
Then it's not a specifically characterized phenomenon.
I think I'm misunderstanding the idea of object. Okay.
Yeah, it's a...
Well,
you know, there's
knowable? Is that what we're talking about here? That to be able to know... Let's see. Being able to... Know your, you know, about your karma is
what's hidden. That's different than
knowing
about.
We can't know karma, right?
But you can infer it validly. But you can make a valid inference, even if it's not.
Because you're making that assumption of taking it on faith.
Well, I think you're pointing out there's a difference between the workings of,
right.
of karma,
right.
and karma yes. and right. karma itself. Mm-hmm. Now, I think we're all clear on the workings of karma. What is karma itself?
Such a thing.
Right.
Right. So it's not a hidden object.
It's almost like, this is a really interesting point. In order for the workings of karma to work, there's some energy, there's some momentum, right,
mm-hmm.
that goes from one entity in one moment to the other. And that gets back to what is it that gets transferred from one moment's mm-hmm. dharmas to the next moment that causes them to appear in a certain way, right?
It's continuity that we can misperceive it.
It's like the weak and strong nuclear forces or something, right? there's fields. It's like there's like entities. Sorry.
Is that accounted for very well in the philosophy of the view?
What's that?
These processes, these moment-to-moment
yes.
continuity.
Yeah,
right.
In one of the recent classes we went through this, the
yeah.
views of the different schools, and some of them have this idea of latency,
mm-hmm.
latent tendencies, vasana of like perfumed
mm-hmm.
things, there's like imbued with a momentum or an energy, and then the Gelugpas came up with this idea of disintegratedness as an entity,
mm-hmm.
right, where something, one dharma arises, and then its disintegratedness ends its continuum, causes it to disintegrate, and causes the next one to arise. Because
I would, I would say there's two answers to that question. One would be his yes, and I think there's equally well a no to that too. Is it accounted for well? I don't think so. It's just a lot of, you know, hypotheses and attempts, and all of them, you know, could be questioned and challenged, right?
And then you could also say it's accounted for well in the sense that if it leads to leaving you without a conceptual understanding, then it's done its job. Right? Well, anyway, we made a little way. But hopefully you get a sense of what this stuff is about.
Will anybody do that next week?
We'll see.
Yeah, because he didn't get it. Just checking. This is the kind of stuff that can drive people
away.
Away or bonkers, whichever the way you want to look at it.
Yeah. So we'll just continue with that and hopefully make it to at least some of the other texts next week.
So for next week, it would be the other article?
Yeah, yeah. And in that article, I mentioned an email, but I'll repeat it again. The first couple of pages, he just like, it's like this list of texts and authors, and it's sort of irrelevant, and it's complicated, and it's just not helpful. So skip those and go to the next subject matter. I will try to repeat that. Anyway.
But then is the book the source book essentially then?
Yeah, this will then be, once we go through those, this will then
be
the...
That.
Yeah, if you want to do the longer course, and we'll go through this book. By this marriage,
may all attain our missions, may defeat the enemy wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.